Hello everybody, today we had Mel Eaves on the show. He was a former professional footballer and is now a top performance coach in mind and body. He's a sports pundit, business growth expert and human behaviour expert. Mel talked about his ups and downs in the sporting world and his career before diving into the power of the mind in reality. Mel is a wise old owl and you will take a lot from this episode. I will see you on the other side. Hiya Mel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolute pleasure, Alex.
We go back a long way, don't we?
We do, we go back quite a way. Back to when you were strutting your stuff, running around the football pitch as a centre-back and at Walsall Football Club. And, you know, you could have gone on to have a promising career as a professional footballer, but it's absolutely wonderful to catch up with you and see what you're doing now, Alex.
Well, likewise, Mel, it's a pleasure to have you on. I know you've had a glittering career yourself. Mel was a professional footballer, as I have mentioned in the intro. A cult hero around here, really. Wolves cult hero, aren't you?
Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure and a dream come true for any young lad to play for his for the team that he supported as a kid. And for me to play for Wolves for nearly 10 years... was a dream come true, and I'm very, very grateful for that experience.
Yeah. And so, how did that come to an end?
Well, it came to an end when 9 years in, I joined straight from school. I stayed on at school a little bit different. You probably wouldn't do it nowadays, but then I stayed on and took A levels. So I didn't leave school till I was 18, and then I joined Wolves as a professional, so I wasn't an apprentice professional, but I just joined them as a professional. And 9 years later, when I was 27, it was towards the end of the season in May, and so it was virtually the last, probably the last away game of the season, I think. And I ruptured my Achilles at 12 minutes past three. May the 5th, 1984. It was at Vicarage Road, Watford, and as Watford are in the Premier League now, it was Wolves were in the First Division, which is the Premier League now for the younger listeners. And their famous manager, Graham Taylor, was managing Watford, and who went on to manage England.
God bless him.
And as I say, we've lost him now just over a year or so ago. And lovely man, met him on many, many occasions when he came to manage Wolves as well. And but yeah, 12 minutes past three. And it was like a gunshot. I was actually lying on the floor. And I'm looking round. I am actually looking for somebody in the crowd with a gun or a shotgun or a pistol.
Really?
Because I was convinced that somebody had, or an air rifle or something had shot me. And so I was kind of in shock and I was bewildered, really. And then I couldn't really move. And then the physio came on. They carried me off to the side. Obviously, I couldn't carry on. But then I was put in they took me in the dressing room. And the dressing room, the old dressing room at Vicarage Road, there was one treatment table in the middle. So they put me on there. And they left me there. So for about 20, 25 minutes, all I could hear was the sound of the crowd. And half time, the doctor comes in then. So obviously he didn't want to, it was, well, somebody's injured, but I'm not going in till half time because I didn't want to miss the football. So the doctor's come in, puts his hand behind my left ankle and utters those words that you probably don't want to hear. He said, oh, there's nothing there. Meaning, obviously, that my Achilles had virtually completely snapped. That was why the sound is... And I've spoken to some of the players that were around me, and they actually heard massive snappers, you know, the sound as well, but didn't realise what it was at the time.
Was it agony?
I think I was in shock, so I can't remember being in immense pain as such, because the adrenaline kicks in, and but it wasn't comfortable. It wasn't comfortable, but I can't remember being in immense...
Yeah, adrenaline.
...pain. So the adrenaline kicks in, and they eventually got me in a car after the game was finished. So I had to then sit in there for the whole of the second half as well. And then they got me sorted out and whisked me in a car up to a hospital in London.
Right.
Completely unexpected. And because apparently you have to have the operation within 24, 48 hours. Especially if it's gone if it's a complete snap. To get any kind of decent recovery,
right,
and rehabilitation, which I did do, but that led me on this quest or a search, first of all, for how I could recover from this in the best possible way. But then that led me into the wider aspect of how the body works, how we work physically, but then also how the medical system works. Because after that, I rehabilitated. I went to from a practical level. I went back to Wolves on because nobody from the club had contacted me. When I went back into the Wolves, they changed manager. They got a new manager. It was a terrible time for the football club in respect to a couple of years earlier they'd gone into liquidation, and they were going to go into liquidation again. The club was in free fall. We actually got relegated at the end of that season. But then it went from Division 1 to Division 2 to Division 3 to Division 4 and nearly went into non-league in successive seasons. It was in absolute shambles, which is totally different to what it is now. It seems to be, fortunately, right on the way up in the opposite spiral, which we'll talk about, spiralling up and down, I'm sure, Alex. But it was really, you know, on a downward spiral. And I remember Tommy Docherty actually was the new manager that they brought in. Coming, I wasn't in the office long. He said, "Oh, hello, Tommy." He said, "We're offering you a pay cut." And I said, "Oh, right." So I've been there 9 years. But he says, "As this will be your 10th year," he says, "you can have a testimonial. We'll grant you a testimonial." I went, "All right. So what you're saying is you want the supporters to actually make up the difference or pay for the fact that you're offering me a pay cut." Only a slight pay cut, but it was a pay cut. He says, "Well, you won't be playing for 6 months." I think just out of the principle of the thing, really, just didn't sit with me, and I could see that there was the culture of the club and everything was just... which wasn't there, didn't seem to be anybody that cared. Everybody, all of the players that I played with, they'd left. Andy Gray had gone to Everton, John Richards had gone to, because he was coming towards the end of his career anyway, as one of the senior players, he'd gone to Portugal. I think Kenny Ibbett was on his way, Wayne Clark had gone.
So the soul of the club.
In other words, the soul of the club was they were just getting rid of everybody could.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was no forward planning. So you could see this place is going nowhere.
Mm.
And I think at the end of the day, people don't stay for buildings or names. They stay for the people and the culture and the feeling and the really the values. And the values were just, there wasn't any, in my opinion.
Mm.
So
was that the ownership?
Yeah, I think every football club or any organisation, really the value or the culture is set from the top down. And if you don't get the right leadership and you don't get the value system from the top, if people, just use an analogy that everybody knows. If you mention Virgin, you think of Richard Branson. So you think of what would Branson do? And that's got his stamp of the way that he would do anything running through it, or he won't allow anybody to put the Virgin name on it, will he?
No.
But I think there was no leadership, there was nobody really taking control. Yes, people then did come in with the right values to steady the ship, and then eventually Sir Jack took over, and obviously his values were top drawer. He wanted to bring it back. So he got it back to some normality, but it took it to go down to the really virtually out of existence. But, you know, fortunately, the council, and which were brilliant at the time, they wouldn't allow that to happen. And then people with the right integrity and values came in and got the club back to some normality.
So yourself, you didn't sign that contract, or you did?
No, I walked out. I said, I'm just going to take my chances then, Tom. I said, I know it might sound crazy, but I'm going to take my chance. Because the only way that you could go anywhere else was if they offered you less money. If they'd have offered me the same money, I probably would have stopped.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But because they didn't, and we weren't on a lot of money then. You know, it wasn't to say, well, they've not offered me the same money. They've only offered me 70 grand a week, and I'm on 100 grand a week. It's just, it was crazy. So I actually then went to Manchester City, who were interested in me anyway. There were quite a few other clubs. But I went to Manchester City, got back, was nearly ready to get back and fight for a first team place somewhere, you know, at City. I played 3 reserve games, scored 3 goals, but I knew I wasn't quite ready yet. But then, funnily enough, Sheffield United came in, spoke to me and said, we'd like to sign you. So I spoke to them at Man City. I said, look, Ian Porterfield at the time, famous player who scored the winning goal for Sunderland in the 1973 Cup Final against Leeds. Smashing guy. And he's the manager at Sheffield United at the time. But I had a word, Billy McNeil, again, absolute legend, who managed at Aston Villa, and also he was Celtic legend, won the European Cup with Celtic in 67. And Billy was the manager, great guy. But I had a word with them at City, and they said, well, you're not quite ready yet, Mel. I said, well, I've got an offer of it here. And so I decided to sign for Sheffield United, because they were both in the same division, which was the second division, or the Championship as it is now. Smashing club as well. So I signed there, and then Virgin, on the Thursday afternoon, went down. Trained on the Friday morning. I only knew one player. That was John Burridge, who was the goalkeeper at Wolves. So obviously, Dean Porterfield had asked Budgie about me. And he started me on the Saturday. And I wasn't quite ready, but I did well. You know, and I did very well at Sheffield United for the first season. Then, unfortunately, got injured again in the pre-season the following year. And this was a different injury. This was a groin injury or a football hernia, which virtually all the players have now, or they pick it up now. And they have a very simple operation which gets everybody right. But they couldn't diagnose it when I played. So I actually went through that season just having injections and different things without them understanding what was going on. And I was even accused by the then chairman at the time that it was in my head.
And I have had that one myself,
But then that questions your integrity.
Yeah.
Which to anybody that has got a value system. He's probably one of the biggest things you can accuse somebody of.
Yeah.
You know, he accused me of not really just picking up the money and not wanting to play. Which I know that that's one of the things that players can be accused of from supporters. That's why I say that I haven't really met a player yet who falls into that category.
No.
Might be players that look as though.
Yeah.
But
That doesn't happen.
No player is going to go out and not put on a performance, even for themselves, on a selfish point of view. But certainly, just picking up the money. But it can look like that, but the vast majority of the time, it's very rare. Anyway, it's very rare. And so I had to leave Sheffield because I couldn't get fit, and then I had some time trying to rehabilitate, and then I went to Gillingham for a couple of years with a smashing guy, Keith Peacock, who was a great manager, and his son, he had Gavin Peacock there, who was the Chelsea player, who was smashing as well, and we got him on loan. I think it was from QPR at the time, or I think he was either at QPR or Chelsea, and he came on loan for a while. So I actually played with Gavin a little bit as well, and a young, which a lot of people can remember, Tony Cascarino, big centre forward.
He's on Talk Sport now, isn't he?
Yeah,
I think.
And I played with Cass, who they'd just signed for a massive fee from non-league. It was the fee was a set of tracksuits. They provided the non-league team with a set of tracksuits, and that was the fee for Tony Cascarino. So Gillingham did very well then, because I think he went for £1 million. I know he went for £1 million from Millwall to Villa, and then Villa to Celtic for probably £1 million. Then he played in France, didn't he,
as well? Yeah, good career, yeah.
So he had a good career after that. So at least he took on board some of the things I told him what to do. I always joke about that when I speak to the big man. So, but yeah, he's smashing. He's doing well for himself.
So what age did you actually retire then?
Now, I retired probably when I was about 31-ish.
Okay.
Which was way before I wanted to retire. Or I had, in my mind, footballers retire officially at 35. So you can get, a football pension at 35. But good players can go on 35 to 40, or even early 40s, depending on how you look after yourselves. Goalkeepers can go, or certainly go on to 40. But, a lot of players have been fortunate enough to go on to 40 playing at a decent, really good level. So I didn't expect to finish before 35, because I was always one of the fittest. But I had to finish quite a few years before, I think, consciously I wanted to, or I'd planned to. Because you keep hanging on. I know the last year that I had, I was trying to rehabilitate, and I eventually had one operation. You see, I got problems with knees, which is footballers' knees. Eventually had the hernia operation, but had it done properly, because I had one done when I was at Gillingham, but it unfortunately didn't make any difference, and it wasn't really done properly. So we got it done properly after that, and then so it got to a stage that just after I'd finished playing, I was actually probably fitter than when I was probably trying to play towards the end of my career, which is crazy. And I'm in less pain now, and probably move better than I did in the last year when I was trying to get fit. Just understanding how the body works, is amazing. And also how the mind-body influence, which I'm sure we'll come on to discuss. And it led me on to looking at a lot of personal development field, the various books on that, and then also the whole world of how we work, both from a physical point of view, how we work, how we move mechanically, what affects us on an internal point of view. In other words, what we put into our body. So I became pretty well an expert on nutrition, and also the more and more over the years, the effect that how we and what we think about actually comes about. That was the clear thing that I think a lot of us can understand from a mechanical point of view. If you put the right things into your body, it's a bit like putting. And then I developed a talk called the 3 E's a few years ago, and the 3 E's meant how we exercise, because there's a lot of the footballers didn't, because I worked going just backtrack slightly. I worked with a wonderful man who's no longer with us called Roger Walters. Now Roger was the senior spring coach for UK Athletics for many years. He was also the senior coach at the Beijing Olympic Games for GB, and he's a former international athlete himself. I think he went to the represented Great Britain in the sprint relays in Munich '72. Then became one of the best sprint coaches in the country. He was actually the coach's coach, so he would lecture, I think, 3 or 4 times a year. I think once in Cardiff, Loughborough, down in London. All of the top athletics coaches. And one lovely story that I know is true, Linford Christie was performing at Crystal Palace, and Roger was on the side just monitoring things, and Linford and Linford's coach came past Roger and said, "What do you think?" And he said, "No, he says, you're going well. Everything looks fine. Except the middle part of your race, you probably need a touch more forward lean, Linford." And he went, he said, "You need 2% more forward lean. That will give you," he said, "Well, what difference will that make?" He says, "That'll give you probably 2 to 3 hundredths of a second." Because we're talking that, because yeah. Linford Christie was at the top of his game. The next Olympic Games, Linford Christie won the gold medal, and it was the one, if you look in the record books, and you could probably YouTube it, where there was a blanket finish. And the first, between the first and third, which was bronze and gold, there was 3 hundredths of a second splitting the first. It was a blanket finish, and he won it. So the difference was that 2% forward lean, yeah, that he introduced into his race.
Yeah, that tiny bit of difference makes everything, doesn't it?
But it's the difference that makes the difference, especially when we're talking top level. Obviously, everybody can improve, and yet they will probably see a massive difference if they're doing things completely wrong. But once you're at the top of your game, it's just
tiny
tweaks. You know, once you're in the Messi Ronaldo class, you've got this lad Mo Salah who's different gravy at Liverpool. It's just the tiny tweaks, because people can do all of the, you know, in isolation, can probably do some of the tricks that. Or are as capable of doing the technical things that they can do, but performing them under pressure consistently, week after week, that's where the difference is.
So you started diving into the world of personal development. How old were you at that point?
I was probably late 20s.
Right. Okay. So what?
So it was after I'd ruptured my Achilles, I got more involved. I probably looked into the nutrition stuff before that, but actually how we work mechanically, how the nutrition side, but more so the personal development, or the how the mind affects, how we think affects our results, and how we do everything, really. Became more of a...
Who was the first person who you sort of delved into? Whose work was it that you looked at first?
There were a few. There were a few around at the time. I think there was... one of the first books I read on personal development was a book called The Magic of Thinking Big. Then you'd look into a lot of the... there was probably some of the first CDs. It'd probably be tapes then for the
yeah cassettes.
it's a bit cassette tapes with stuff from people, Anthony Robbins, Tony Robbins, so
Jim Rohn.
There was Jim Rohn,
Zig Ziglar,
Tony Robbins, obviously Zig Ziglar. Even then, there's Bob Proctor was probably even more so now. He was one of the when I first saw Bob Proctor probably 10, 15 years ago in London live. It's probably 15 years ago, but that I'd read about before. Then coming on to the more, because what I look into, because I've already saw personal development can probably have a left and a right wing, if that makes sense. So you've got right wing, say straight in your face, which can be more up and at 'em and a bit more rah-rah, but still gives the same message as Tony Robbins.
Yeah,
if you get where I'm coming from. And that kind of fits his personality, 6'8".
Yeah.
Pretty loud, pretty straight at you. But he's still delivering the same message as what I pull on the left-hand side. Oh, I saw live and in person in Manchester probably over 10 years ago now, but I'd read loads of his books before that, was Deepak Chopra. And Deepak Chopra will give the same message, but he's very, very more softer spoken and coming from a...
more spirituality aspect.
But they're both highly spiritual, both giving the same message. And this is why it's wonderful, because underneath, they're delivering the message, but at different times, and then also different people are going to receive the message, are going to pick it up and run with it. And that's what I believe we're all here for. You will speak the same language, I will speak the same language, but different people will understand it. Or we will even speak different languages, or put it across differently. But the big thing is that there is far more out there than we have, the vast majority of people, especially in the Western culture, have been led to believe, is how we actually work as human beings, how we operate. And really, it's all down to our culture. We talked about culture and values. That is embedded into our, what I'd call our operating system, or our mind. Why do we do the things that we do? And a lot of it is through habit, but we don't even know where we've picked those habits up, because we pick them up from our early conditioning. So what our early conditioning is actually defines us, because they've done, there's been lots of studies done on twins. So you'll get identical twins and they get split up at birth. They're both perfectly healthy, so they're literally identical. So they've both been born, maybe exactly the same weight, all the tests been done on them, And then for some reason, they get split up. So one is lives in a Western culture, the other one might be in an Eastern culture. And they get brought up. Now, the one in the Western culture, say if he's in England, will grow up speaking English. So the other twin goes to Japan. He's gonna grow up speaking Japanese. But also everything else about the culture, they will pick up. And so they are products of their environment. So even though they're identical, the only thing that they're going to be recognisable, or is what you would call, you can tell they're twins, is they'll still look alike. They'll still have the same features as their family, and that's why they'll probably have the same nose as their grandfather, or they'll certainly be this. Their skin will be this similar to their parents.
Yeah.
Their eye colour, etc. But everything else about their habits and the way that they view the world and what they do, how they interact with everybody, etc., is all down to what they have learned in the first 6 years of their life. Because the first 6 years, we do not have a conscious, subconscious reasoning barrier. So we just take everything in, because we are in what you would call a theta brainwave state, which is that is the hypnotic state. So any hypnotists out there will know that you cannot hypnotize anybody unless you get them into a theta brainwave state. So, but when we're kids, we are automatically in that state. We just take everything in. And we take everything in because we are creatures of our, well, products of our environment. We do that because it keeps us safe. As a species, that's how we look after our young. A lot of other species, they're okay, they're pretty well okay once they're born, they can look after themselves. Human beings are really dependent, especially on their environment, until at least 6 or 7, mm-hmm. before they could probably go and fend for themselves.
Yeah.
So
people run these patterns all their life, don't they? Unless they become aware of what's going on.
Good point, Alex. Yeah. And so unless we become aware, and we can start to ask, and that's why kids start to ask questions.
Yeah.
But unless they actually become aware that, and the big thing is, and a lot of what I teach, and I know that we've spoken about this, Alex, is that once you realise that you have the power, that we all have the power to choose what we do or what state we put ourselves in. Because you hear it all the time, oh, so-and-so's in a right state. Now, that is probably due to our automatic conditioning to react in a certain way under certain conditions. But the big thing is that we can learn to actually control that, and we can learn to put ourselves in an empowering state as opposed to a disempowering state. But the vast majority of people are actually, that's part of the conditioning, is that we are dependent on what the people looking after us say. First of all, it's what our parents say. First of all, it's what our peers or our teachers or anybody who's controlling us. The vast majority of the time, the control is for our own good, and we all benefit from it. That's the point. It keeps us safe. But especially, and a lot of the time, it's okay when we're kids. But when we come in through being a teenager, and then we have to fend for ourselves or make our own way in the world, it can hold us back, because when we should be making empowering decisions, we make disempowering positions. When we should be putting ourselves forward to speak, for instance, when we should be put, we hold back. We hold back because in the past, that's kept us safe. So when we need to put ourselves forward for a promotion, or when we need to put ourselves forward for the ideal job, we sometimes don't go for it, or we hold ourselves back because we feel that we're not good enough, or we feel that we're not worthy of that, or because not consciously but subconsciously something's going on where we've been held back for our own good.
Yeah.
We're kids. And a lot of the time, it's understanding that there's a lot of things going on what we would call subconsciously, and it's the subconscious that runs the show. That's the thing, because you've got millions of things going on in the subconscious, because we can only think of a few things consciously. We can only think up to about, I think, 10 dozen or so things at the same time. And me and you, Alex, could probably only think of a half of that, because it's only females that can multitask. But yeah, and that's the big thing, really. It's just understanding more and more, and this 30 odd year quest that I've been on, I think is never ending, by the way.
The more you learn, the more you realise you need to learn, don't it?
Yes, and I am just a perpetual and never ending seeker, and of knowledge and of the way things work.
Yeah, I think science is now starting to catch up with what some of the ancient civilizations were saying thousands of years ago.
Absolutely. And I did, funnily enough, it didn't make any difference when I played football, but I have got A-level physics, maths and physics, and so looking into it, but obviously the physics that I was taught at school was what you call Newtonian physics, or how the bigger stuff works.
Linear.
So, but quantum physics, and the quantum physicists all agree that everything is energy, just vibrating at different levels. Now, and the big thing is that the quantum world, and we've known about this about 100 years because of the double slit experiment, if you look at that, just put in double slit experiment and it'll come up. And that just proves, and they've tried this so many different ways to get different results, and it always proves that quantum physics works on a totally different, and the results come out totally different than what you would expect from the classical Newtonian model. So the bottom line is that from all the quantum physicists agree, because everything is energy, so he's thinking, so what's a thought? We know what this card is here, or this cup that we've got on the table, or the table itself. We know that's energy, but it's energy vibrating at a fairly low level, because we can see it, and B, we can touch it. But what is a thought? Thought is it's just a ball of energy vibrating at a very high energy. But does that thought behave in the same way as this cup of tea that's on the table? A, I can't touch it. B, I can't see it.
Yep.
Does it behave like that? That if I pick it up and then I just drop it like that, is it in other words, does gravity affect it in the same way? In other words, it quantum world behaves totally differently to the Newtonian world, or the big stuff, or everything that we've been taught in school. So we've all heard the saying, well, I'll believe it when I see it. in the quantum world and the way that we work as human beings, the reality is you will not see it until you believe it.
Which is quite a difficult concept.
Which is a very, very difficult concept. And I think it was one of the presenters on one of the things that will probably come up first on YouTube if you Google the double slit experiment. It was a very, very famous TV presenter and still does a lot now. He said, if anybody can explain logically how that result comes about, that matter or the tiniest particle actually depends on whether it's being viewed, or in other words, the result depends on the observer. So if something is being observed or thought about, it may go into a
particle
or waves. So it may go into if it's not being observed, I think it usually goes into a particle, but it could be in a wave. So things either react one way or the other. But if that is the case, then what we think about comes about. And there are a lot of people, there's work from, is it Mike Doyle? There's a lot on that, what we think about comes about.
Joe Dispenza.
There's Joe Dispenza, Dr. Joe Dispenza, who I've read a lot of his work as well.
Greg Braden, he's a good one
as well. Greg Braden, I have learned an awful lot from, and he's certainly worth looking into for everybody that's listening. Greg Braden did a talk in Milan, Italy, probably 10 years ago, which is on one of his... there's a good YouTube on this. But this is where they looked into the medicineless hospital.
That's phenomenal, isn't it?
In China. Now, this is something for people to get their head around if they're not kind of in... If this is the first time you've looked into this subject, it will blow your brains out a little bit, because this is exactly what we're talking about, in that what you think about comes about. So a medicineless hospital will actually test our beliefs. And this is the one thing that I talk about. So how do we get results? We get results, go all the way back to the beginning. So the first thing is we are conditioned. So we will call that, our belief system is put onto our pristine, say, hard drive when we're born. So we have to put the software. We load the software in on, or we call that the operating system. We load that on, and that's put on there the first 6 years. So everything that we do, our beliefs come from that. But the good thing is that we can change the beliefs, so that there are a lot of people that have been born into crazy situations and been brought up into crazy, have had some, what you would call, strange, for computer terms, viruses on their system. But because they've become more aware, they've been able to take the viruses out. And that's what we can do. But the vast majority of people don't realise, A, they've got viruses, and B, they can take them out.
Or C, they want to. There is a payoff.
Well, yes, but then because when people become aware but they don't want to do it, it's because it serves them better to stay where they are.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
And there's also a fear a fear of change, because as human beings, we, the most, the people that, that do very well are more receptive and will have got more courage to actually change themselves and make changes. Because we become the big thing with the human condition is we will tolerate an awful lot, and we become very good at tolerating stuff, and really the less you tolerate stuff and the more that you actually have the courage to change it and do it how you would want it done, as opposed to tolerating stuff that isn't quite good enough but I'll put up with it, the better chance you've got of actually getting what you really want instead of what you're tolerating.
Mm. Yeah.
Going back to that, things actually do work totally differently to how we've been led to believe. So it is a big challenge to our conscious mind. Because our conscious mind, I think it was Jim Keneally that was the presenter, said there's a Nobel Prize working for anybody that can logically explain how this works. Because logically, you can't.
No, impossible.
Because it's beyond our world of reason. And if we go into another one of my mentors, Dr. David Hawkins, and his book, Power Versus Force... Dr. David Hawkins was a professor, doctor in New York in the 50s, 60s, where he started to make his name. And all of the other doctors, and whether it be psychiatrists or just GPs or physios, whatever, if they couldn't get their patients... stroke clients better, he was the go-to person. They referred them to David Hawkins, and David Hawkins had a really high percentage rate of getting everybody well, but he did it the same way. He just got them into what you would call an empowered state, as opposed to a disempowering state. So it's a state of courage and love, acceptance, as opposed to being exposed to a fear state, or they're angry about everything, or they're in an apathetic state, for instance, where nothing can be done, etc. So he just raised their what we would call vibration, because everything's energy, just vibrating at different levels. So he's raised their energy levels so that they're in a more empowering state. Once they became in that empowered state, whatever their condition disappeared. And whether that was a physical condition or what we would call an emotional condition that was labelled by the psychiatrist as they've got PTSD or they've got XYZ or they've got touching the table syndrome. You can
just a label.
Yeah, well, it's just a label. Yeah. Just a label, Alex, yeah. So whatever they were labelled as having actually disappeared when they got themselves in a more empowered state. And a lot of the eminent doctors in the world actually say that doctors don't do anything. They just allow the body's own healing powers to actually do the job, because we are designed as human beings to heal ourselves.
Of course we are. Same as anywhere in nature.
And that's how nature works.
Yeah.
So we are in... And once we get at one with nature, once we understand how we... how we work. You know, it's like a good mechanic knows how a car engine works, if the body needs sorting out, if the wheels need sorting out, if it's the engine, they know how it works. But we are every time you'll get a brand new car, or you get a, you'll get the operating manual, won't you? As human beings, we come here with the most sophisticated operating system the world has ever seen as a human being. And we don't have an operating system. We don't have a guidance manual to say how we work. Every sophisticated computer, you've got a Apple computer on the desk here, Alex. I'm sure that came with instructions of how to use it.
Mm, yeah,
we don't. We just pick it. We just pick it up from our environment. We haven't got a clue. We just do things. But the thing is that then we are taught, unlike every other mammal that operates from instinct, we are taught to just trust our five senses. What we hear, see, smell, touch and taste. But we have a sixth sense that if we learn to actually understand it and trust it, never lets us down. We're not taught to trust that. We're not even told about it the vast majority of the time in our culture.
And that would be intuition?
Yes. So when an animal goes in nature, an animal goes, say, a dog will go up to what might be food. They'll usually just sniff it. If it's edible, they fancy it, they'll eat it. If they're not, they'll just walk off, won't they? They go, no, not for me. They don't actually pick it up, look at the ingredients and go, oh, it's got so-and-so in it, I can't have that. Or, oh, yeah, it's okay. So, and they've done this, haven't they? One of the fast food outlets, they've gone in there, taken a burger from a fast food outlet. They've put it in the wild. And they've, at a distance, they've kept the filming it. So it's not going to upset any of the... So there's no humans there, but they've filmed it secretly. There's bugs and what have you have crawled over it, but there's... And then left it. Animals have come and sniffed it, just walked past it. Nothing's touched it. In fact, after a month, it's exactly in the same pristine condition as it was when it was put there. Why is that? Because they haven't recognised it as food. They haven't seen the TV adverts that say, come and eat this, you get 2 for 1, it's only £1 or £2, whatever. So they've crawled all over it. Not even the slugs and whatever. It's not been touched. So in other words, it's not food. It's of no use whatsoever. Yet we'll eat it. And then we wonder why we get problems. But that's another...
Yeah.
It's another chat, isn't it? But then... When we get... Then we are the only species that actually goes into... We get told what to eat. We don't trust our gut feeling on what to eat, but we can actually teach that, because that's, I actually just use what Dr. David Hawkins used to construct his scale of consciousness from 0 to 1,000. We used a technique called kinesiology, which is muscle testing. So it's a really good technique, so we can start to trust ourselves, that intuitively we know what's right for us. And if you look up kinesiology, it's obviously muscle testing, and it's been used. It's the basis of lie detectors and what have you. So it really is intuitively, or if you are... in integrity and what have you, you can trust yourself, then it's a great way of helping you make decisions.
I think the issue with it can't actually be proven, can it? And that's the issue why science won't use it as such.
Well, yes, because they won't use stuff that... because this works on what you would call quantum physics. Because quantum physics is you will see it when you believe it, right? Newtonian physics, well, I'll believe it when I see it. They're actually looking at, the way that they will think about this, or their logic stops at the, what you would call reasoning level, which is halfway up Dr. David Hawking's scale. Anything above his 500, because it goes from 0 to 1,000, 500 and above is where the magic happens, is where things actually do work.
Transcend.
It's transcending the conscious. Because we have three... the easy way to look at it is we've got three states of consciousness. We have the conscious mind, or we have three states, conscious mind, the subconscious, but the superconscious is where we actually start to understand about universal consciousness, and also this is our spirit.
Which is where spirit comes in, yeah.
Which is where the spirit. Now, that's why when people ask me, they said, oh, well, you do all this motivation, do you do the motivational talks? I say, no, I don't do motivational talks. I do inspirational talks, and inspirational is in spirit. Motivate is, you may be able to do a motivational talk at half time in a football match. It's very short, it's a very short
burst of energy, if you like.
It's a very short tool or technique to get somebody to react or do something.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is that that's why I say it's a half-time tactic or technique as opposed to a lasting tactic or technique. It's not a lasting modality. Whereas if you can inspire somebody, it will have a lasting effect on them. So when you inspire somebody and they can trace that back, you've actually changed their paradigm. You've expanded their comfort zone, or their zone of what they feel they can achieve. You can get somebody through a short-term motivational speech, brilliant, but only just before somebody goes out to compete or do something at half-time in a football match is the ideal thing as well. But I've seen a lot of very good managers that may be good motivators, but that's why they keep moving clubs every so often. Because they're not really that inspirational. Hmm. And sometimes you can rule, as we know, by fear.
Well, that's been what's been happening for thousands of years, isn't it?
And there's been a lot of we both come from a football background, so there's a lot of managers, as we know, and coaches that rule by fear.
Yeah.
But they only last... Therefore, they have to move on after so long because people then start to rebel and they don't react. So what I call the rule by fear characters have a certain shelf life at each club, and then eventually the whole football world gets to know about them, and that's why they don't get a job. So the ones that last really a long time know the game, and they're more inspirational than motivational. So anybody that lasts a good time is they generally know what they've got a little bit of a handle on what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Or they're certainly touching it.
Yeah.
But I think that the football world in general, I think, can benefit from taking a more... understanding there is more than what you would call the conventional approach, but that goes through society, the health system, the education system and everything. But I think things are changing, Alex. I think I give talks very regularly now, and I gave a talk probably 10 years ago, and then gave a similar talk to a similar audience a year ago, and there was far more acceptance into the fact that it is what we call an inside-out job. So that comes to, we've been conditioned that it's an outside-in job. So in other words, we've got, when you get this job, when you get that salary, when I get that house in that area, when I've got that ideal partner, when I've got that ideal family, in other words, when I've got this ideal phone or computer, when I've got, in other words, anything that's outside of us makes us happy. Well, when I've done that, I'll be happy. We've seen that plenty of people that have gone up what we would call the outside-in model. When I've got this, when I've achieved this, I'll be happy. There are plenty of examples of people that have got to the top of that ladder. Hollywood A-listers that have got to the top of that ladder, that to any 99.9% of the people in the world, they would think, oh, what have they got to worry about?
Yeah,
they're super successful. Everybody loves them. Millions, billions of people know who they are. They're lauded by everybody. They love. They've got so much approval. They've got multi-billion, probably billions in the bank. They've got
everything anyone could wish for.
They've got absolutely everything anyone could wish for, and yet it comes on the news: so and so found dead, committed suicide. You're thinking, well, what's all that about? What is all that about? And then you find out, oh, they were obviously unhappy about something. So it isn't as straightforward as, when I get this, I'll be happy. When I get that, I'll be happy. When I do this, I'll be happy. That's the outside-in model. The inside-out model, which is more of the, comes into the spiritual world.
Yeah. And so quantum world if you're scientific, the spiritual world if you're more spiritual based, all the same concepts really.
Yeah. In other words, but the quantum world is, the quantum world actually proves that the spiritual has such a big part to play.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean to say that you don't have to do. In other words, we still have to. We're here as human beings. We're here as human beings to have this physical experience. So even if we may be spiritual beings having this mind, body or earthly experience, we've still got to get the balance right. So it's all about being practical. Yes, there are a few people who may think your gurus are in their caves in the Himalayas in India and just sitting there. Yeah, one or two people might be. That's why they're here. The vast majority of people are here to have this earthly experience and to operate in human beings and have all the experiences that that we all do, good and bad. What we would call good and bad, but that's only a judgment. It's just different experiences.
Perception.
But it's all about perception and how we. Our take on things, which is obviously influenced massively by our conditioning or our beliefs. So it's all a case of this. Now, the inside-out model is what we think about comes about. So and it's very difficult for people to get this, because it's very difficult to say, well, yes, I'm happy, if on the outside it looks as though your world's falling apart. Oh, my house, I'm going to get my house repossessed. The car's, the, They've come and collected the car. My partner's left me. I'm probably going to be homeless soon. I've got no job, whatever. Then, yes, on the outside, it looks as though everything's fallen apart and you've got absolutely nothing to be happy about. The truth is, once you actually change, and which one of my strap lines is, your attitude determines your altitude. How you think determines your outcome. Now, the challenge is that there is always what you call a gestation period of when you sow the seed of an idea, it takes time for it to germinate. So, as human beings, we have a 9-month gestation period. Elephants have a lot longer. Smaller mammals have smaller. If you plant the seed of a bamboo tree, it can take, the giant bamboo can take up to 5-6 years for anything to happen. But the thing is, we have to trust and understand that what we think about does come about all of the time. But most of us are thinking negatively, especially the words we use to ourselves. So we will always get what we think about. And if we're always thinking, well, nothing's happening, nobody's doing this, that's what we're always going to get, because this is where this law of attraction business comes in. And that's another one of the universal laws. But the vast majority of the time, people will say, well, I don't want that. Why am I getting it? It's because subconsciously, that's what's going on. We've got a record going on, or a loop, somewhere. I'm not worthy. I am not loved. I'm not good enough. We've got some kind of loop that's going on. And
so the outer reality is reflecting what's really going on there.
Yes. And so if you want to know what's going on, you know, and it's not easy, because I'm still working this out. I know you are, Alex.
I think that's why we're here, mate.
And that's why we're still here. Yeah, that's why we're here. Because we've got our own challenges, but at the same time, I know I'm here to get the message out to everybody else. I know I'm here to empower people. I know I'm here to teach and coach. And that's why I'm just here to help. And I feel I'm passionate about it. I think that's what inspires me.
So what are you doing now? Have you got any workshops, courses going on?
I've got, the next chance to actually have to see me, I've got, I'm at a Coffee and Natter, which is a free networking event in Warsaw, and the Thursday the 19th of April, which is a free event. You can just go, and you can find the details if you just go straight onto my web page, which is Mel, Eves, E-V-E-S, no A, .com. And it's on the front there, and it'll tell you what my next event is, and that's it. Then I do my own workshops probably every month, seminars, which is an introductory one, which I know you've been on, Alex. That's a more in-depth dive into it for 4 hours, and then we go even deeper after that. You know, we groups. Group sessions and that. So it's I'm loving it, absolutely loving it. I think that, like everybody else, I procrastinated a little bit and needed a little bit of a push from the universe to get me into this. No, that's what I love doing now.
Well, you're on the path, mate, and I can tell that you're very passionate about it.
And
your heart's made of gold, mate, and I think that's probably the main thing for anybody to take from anybody in it.
Yeah, well, I think it's great to actually get to know you again after we first met when you were with your football, and I'm really right behind everything that you're doing with your career now, and I know you're really passionate about getting the message out there to help the young up-and-coming entrepreneurs, in this world, and that's what's going to save the planet is the millennials, is your generation coming through. Anything I can do, as more of the old guy with the wisdom that looks like
That's
the looks like the wizard Hopefully, I'm the
hermit.
I'm the white wizard that just passes on a little bit of, I think, wise counsel, hopefully.
Yeah.
And I'm loving it. Brilliant.
Mel, thanks a lot for your time. Cheers for coming on.
Thanks a lot, Alex. Pleasure.